Today on the GeoTrek podcast, we're joined by Julie K. Roberts, a nationally recognized expert in crisis communication and emergency management. With over 20 years of experience leading response efforts across public and private sectors, she's seen firsthand how the right words at the right time can save lives. Hey everyone, I'm Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast. On the GeoTrek podcast, we explore the world to bring you stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow our content on social media and your favorite podcast platforms so you make sure you don't miss any critical updates from the GeoTrek podcast. We're active, we're out there in the field, we're on social media, and we're very engaged. We want you to stay up to date so you don't miss anything going on here at GeoTrek. Without further introduction, let's jump into this podcast episode with Julie Roberts. Julie, thanks so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Thanks, Hal. I really appreciate you inviting me on today.
Julie, I kind of want to do this podcast looking at your past, present, and future. So let's go back. I see that you're an ETBU grad, East Texas Baptist University. I have a lot of friends there. My closest one being my wife. She's an alum of ETBU, spent a bunch of her life in Marshall, Texas and East Texas. So I have to ask you, I've met a lot of ETBU grads. I've never met anyone go the route you have with all this high-level crisis communication work you've done. Could you kind of walk us through your timeline? I mean, how did you get from ETBU to all the stuff you've done professionally? How does someone like you get into crisis communication?
Well, Hal, I had no idea that we would have a connection into Marshall, Texas. And for your listeners that have no idea, Marshall's a sleepy little town of about 25,000 in Far East Texas. And I actually grew up in Marshall. So I grew up in Marshall, went off to college for a couple years and came back home. I graduated from East Texas Baptist University. And, you know, it's interesting because I used to advise sorority girls. I had been a Zeta at Stephen F. Austin. And when I would advise these girls, I would always tell them, if I can do what I've been able to accomplish, and I grew up in a small town, East Texas, raised by a single mom, like anybody can do anything. Just put your head down and don't let anybody tell you not to. And I've known since I was a little girl, I wanted to one day go to Washington, D.C. and work in a presidential administration. And so I had that chance in 2001 to work for President Bush's administration for 4 years, lived there during 9/11, worked at FEMA briefly at the beginning, but really had a chance to see like the federal government in action and found myself, I mean, I have a degree in strategic communications and political science, right? So kind of set myself up, knew from the time I was little that that was the route I wanted to go. I was never a math person. I was always a comms person. And so had that opportunity and then found myself in emergency management at the state of Florida and was doing external affairs and communications and public education. And so really just fell into that, you can throw something at me and it takes a lot to make me, you know, stumble. And so it's just about being confident and understanding your facts and being able to speak to somebody on the fly.
Yeah, it sounds like it was step by step with you, but you really had this vision all along. It sounded like you wanted to do some work with the federal government and spend some time in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I knew since I was 10 and people laughed at me. And I also walked into college with a communications degree and I graduated. And at one point, my advisor said, well, let's see if we can get you a different degree or minor to get you out of here faster. And I said, you never took any other classes. And I said, no, I've known what I wanted to do my whole life. Like, this is what I wanted to be doing. And so I was very fortunate to be able to do that and to also be able to serve in a presidential administration to make a difference to be there on 9/11, interesting enough, I see where I guess President Bush is back on TikTok now. The Zoomers are like finding him and are all interested in his administration. It's kind of interesting. But and so, I always knew what I wanted to do. And then, you know, I followed that through. I went to Florida and then I went back to D.C. I was the comms director for NOAA and then deputy chief of staff as well. And so dealing with those crises. But I'd always known kind of what I wanted to do with my life.
For sure. There's so much to unpack here. I got to ask you about 9/11. I mean, what were you doing? Were you doing strategic communication on that day professionally, or what was that like for you?
So I was actually working at the Department of Labor, working in a retirement office, a retirement and benefits office for an undersecretary. I was in my car in D.C. when it happened. I was heading to a doctor's appointment, didn't know what was going on. My mom's on the phone with me and I hear the second plane hits. And you still don't think, right? I mean, now we would think. go to the doctor. I come back down through downtown Georgetown and I see the Pentagon on fire and it's still not resonating with me what's going on. I actually stopped and bought bagels because I thought I needed to go back to work. I was in a political job. I was in my 20s. And my dad finally got me on the phone and said, no, you're not going back to work. And I was near the White House at this point. And at that moment, I looked up and I saw Secret Service and guns and things that I had never seen before and realized really quickly how real it was.
You're bringing back some powerful memories also about the uncertainty. We forget that, right? As that day unfolded, even on the ground, it was really hard to connect the dots because this was so far outside anyone's frame of reference, right?
Yeah, especially the first plane, right? Everyone's like, oh, a Cessna, man, something must have happened to the pilot. It was a small plane that hit the, you know, World Trade Center. And then even the second plane, people are like, what? You know, and I will say it was obviously scary. I'd only been there for a few months, didn't really know many people in D.C. But I will say that, you know, seeing President Bush step up the way he did and having that moment of leadership and showing like we're here and we're going to fight back. And so it was a real honor. I felt really honored to be able to serve in his administration for 4 years. I worked for Secretary Chow at the Department of Labor. I actually ended up scheduling her. And I kind of cut my teeth on that, which was a really tough job. And then I went over and worked on international trade at the Department of Commerce. And I tell people we negotiated things like lumber and aluminum and steel in 20 years ago. And here we are talking about it again. And then my last job, which I was really lucky, I spent over a year in the Netherlands at the U.S. Embassy. I worked for the ambassador as a political appointee. And, you know, I got to meet Colin Powell, and who was a hero of mine. And I got to host the spouses for Justice O'Connor's husband and for Justice Kennedy's wife. And so, you know, I watched John Ashcroft, the attorney general, play the piano. I mean, I'm like, you know, 30 years old at this point going, how the heck did I get here from Marshall, yeah. Texas?
Well, that's it. Well, you know, and once you step into the international game, right? I lived in North Africa for several years and we get a text, hey, bring all your American friends. The ambassador's having hot dogs for the 4th of July. And you're like, I'm 26 years old. You know, all of a sudden you start meeting these people. And like you said, you're like, how did I get in this place? I'm in the Netherlands. I'm in my 20s. And all of a sudden it sounds like you're meeting all these people and your world is just expanding so quickly, right?
It is. And it was, you know, I was there from 04 until mid 05. And that was after 9/11. And the Dutch led a lot of the efforts on port safety and airport safety. And so we had all these, you know, newly formed DHS officials coming over and hanging out with us and seeing what was going on. And, you know, I got a challenge coin, which are, you know, infamous in like emergency management, from the Joint Chief of Staff. Like, holy cow, like, how am I doing this, right? But yeah, and, you know, we had Marine house parties. Some of my best friends are still the Marines that were there with me over 20 years ago. Those Marine house parties were fun. I helped throw the July 4th celebration that year, which meant a lot to the Americans to come together. And so it was a really interesting time and gave me another opportunity to also understand communication. So I learned to get rid of my Texas drawl while I was there because I wanted the Dutch people to understand me. And so it was being able to communicate in different ways and being able to explain what we were trying to explain to a different audience as well.
Julie, NOAA does such strategic communications with disasters, extreme weather, hurricanes, floods. You held some pretty high level roles there with NOAA doing communication. Walk us through what you did with NOAA.
So I started in August of 2017, so 8 years ago, right about now, actually, right before Harvey. I was hired in as the director of communications. And at first I thought, well, why am I? So I served in the Trump administration. I went back to D.C. I was part of the Trump-Pence administration. And at first I was like, why am I not going to FEMA? Why am I going to NOAA? But in the end, it was a perfect chance because I really focused on that relationship between NOAA and FEMA. I used to always say, why am I putting the FEMA administrator in the Oval Office with a NOAA map and nobody from NOAA there? And so I advocated and got the administrator into the Oval Office for the briefings as well. And we had everything, you know, so I was the only communication person exempted during the government shutdown at Christmas of 2018. And I actually advocated to be working without being paid. And it was because I knew we needed a communication person. And that was probably the best thing that could have happened to me, because in that moment, I became the person for all of the components of NOAA. And people think National Hurricane Center, National Weather Service, but there's oceans, there's a satellite and, you know, component, there's the fisheries. And so I was dealing everything from a potential whale stranding off of Washington State to an arrest by fisheries in the Florida Keys for illegal fishing. And so I, you know, and then all the weather service, right? We were constantly updating because it was winter weather. And so being able to work with the staff that was working during that time and being able to understand, I used to tell people I had the coolest job. I got to talk about everything from the floor of the ocean to the surface of the sun and everything in between. And so I was really honored to be able to work for NOAA to help communicate the messaging. And about halfway through in, I became director of comms, but also deputy chief of staff. So my role expanded a little bit more into some of the policy side of the house.
Well, for sure. And, you know, NOAA is doing so much good applied science. And then you're there in 2017, 2018. There were a lot of disasters in that time as well. I think that communication work was so important and strategic.
Yeah, especially, you know, Harvey being the first hurricane that came in under President Trump and Vice President Pence. So I went down with Vice President Pence and got to see the devastation on the ground in South Texas. And then in 2018, Hurricane Michael. So at this point, I had gotten to be pretty close to the senior leadership at the Department of Commerce, which is where NOAA sits. And I will never forget that weekend was a long weekend. And I was watching Hurricane Michael come off the coast. And I thought, man, something just does not sit right with this one. And so I reached out to the most senior leadership at Commerce and said, Monday's a holiday. I'm just not feeling great about this one. And by Tuesday, we had a massive hurricane into the Gulf. And later that week, it was a Cat 5 that went into the panhandle of Florida. Fast forward about 6 months later, the Hurricane Center is going to reclassify this, right? Because it originally was classified a 4. And they're saying, hey, now we've confirmed it's a 5. And I actually advocated to let the governor know, let the local media know. And people were like, well, why does that matter? And I'm like, because it's the first Cat 5 since Andrew to make landfall on the continental U.S. And so understanding what did that look like, it was interesting. In one of the senior staff meetings, they were saying that there was a solar flare that was causing some problems, but it was up in New York, so it didn't matter. And it was during Maria. And I said, well, guys, it does matter because it's interfering with comms and Hurricane Maria is coming out of New York. So like, and they were like, oh, we hadn't thought about that. So I had a real opportunity to find ways to integrate what NOAA does into what the emergency management field is talking about and make that connection. Acting NOAA Administrator Neil Jacobs and I, we went to FEMA, to the NRCC on a regular basis and integrated over there. And I introduced him to Brock Long and was like, hey, we need to talk about what does this look like? We're here. We're seeing that it's going to flood in 5 days here. Are you guys paying attention to that? So it was a real opportunity to talk through that.
You know, Julie, something I'm learning from talking to you, it sounds like you've been able to make connections. Like yeah. Maria's hitting Puerto Rico, but you're realizing there's a lot of people in Florida and New York and these other places that if they're not there, they have family back there, right? All of a sudden everything's connected. And it sounds like you were making those connections and communicating to people like we need to communicate very thoroughly all throughout.
Yeah. I mean, communication is the biggest thing, especially in a disaster, right? So, you know, 2017, 8 years ago, social media was out there, but nothing like it is now. We saw it during Helene, a lot of misinformation that quickly spreads during these disasters. And so it's also how do we take and make sure that we're conveying correct information using resources that we know are reliable and credible, and then being able to come in and counter that misinformation. Because my concern when it comes to communicating disasters is, if we don't jump in front of social media and start to really tell the truth and being able to counter that the lies that are out there, you're going to have people die. You're going to have people that don't know where to ask for assistance. And so I think it's really important that we all think about how we communicate during disasters in particular.
Well, Julian, this transitions into your current role. I mean, with all this government experience, now you're working in the private sector, and it sounds like you're coming alongside communities and businesses and organizations to help them communicate better. I really like this focus that you're sharing, that social media is something we really need to be aware of as far as, you know, we're putting out credible information and a lot of times fighting against misinformation. How do you help your clients have a path forward to do that well?
So, you know, I always tell my clients, whether you're talking about a wildfire or a hurricane that we can maybe see coming or an active threat, an active shooter, you've got to know ahead of time, what is your communication strategy? My recommendation is always to have a web page that's offline, but can convey that information immediately that you can turn on if there's a crisis that says, here's the resources we have right now. More information is to come. You got to find that spokesperson that you trust. And it's not going to be your CEO. It's going to be either your communication person or maybe an operations person, depending on the crisis. But it's also being able to make sure they have had some training. They know how to speak. You know, we see when these active shooter incidents happen, whether it's at a school or at a public space, all of a sudden you've got people who are not used to having cameras, and it's not your local reporter in your face any longer. It's now a bank of national and international reporters. They're asking questions. And so having a person who can go in and speak, feel confident, also ensuring that whatever you're saying is the facts in the moment. And it is okay to say, we don't have that information right now, but as soon as we do, we'll get it back out to you. And also then providing out where to find the correct information, and then also having that person that can do your social media and already have that teed up, ready to go. And it may be very simple things. We're tracking the situation and we'll follow back up. But again, social media, if you're not on top of it, you're behind the ball the moment the disaster happens. We no longer live in a world that somebody can issue a press release in 5 hours or a press conference in 20 hours or whatever it might have been 20 years ago. It is an immediate response that has to happen right away.
Julie, would you say two of the most important things are finding that point person and, like you said, developing some of these social media resources offline? So if something does break down really quickly, you can spin that up pretty quickly, right?
Yeah, I recommend having, it can be a very basic plan, just having that plan. And it may be a small business. It doesn't have to be a big corporation. You could have a small business that somebody's come in and done something and you need to be able to respond that could impact your brand, whether you're a mom and pop, you know, a business or a large corporation. Have 5 social media posts that can immediately go out that just say, hey, we're monitoring. This is where you can make a phone call if you need information. And then again, if you've got a website, just having something that you can put a banner up there. It doesn't even have to be a web page, but having all of that in your back pocket, hoping that you never need it, but it's better to have a plan and not need it than to be scrambling at the last minute to try to come up with something.
Julie, what about a rapidly evolving situation, say an active shooter, and all of a sudden the phone's ringing off the hook? I mean, what do you kind of like, for example, have a press conference kind of thing, if you want to call it that, at the top of the hour and just tell everyone, hey, we're going to do our best update in 25 minutes or something like that? I mean, how do you deal with something like that that's evolving so rapidly?
Well, and if you're in the private sector, the one thing I recommend is also getting to know who your law enforcement partners are at the local level, but also even at the federal level. If you're in a big city, you've got FBI, you know, departments around, regional offices around, because in an active shooter situation, it doesn't matter what size company you are, you're not going to own that any longer, right? The law enforcement of some level is going to be coming in there, and you sure don't want to be shaking hands and exchanging a business card when something has happened and you have employees that have been impacted or customers impacted. And so understanding who those players are and being able to communicate together, and also not getting out in front of law enforcement, but being there so that they know that you're ready to speak with them as well. And if you're not wanting to speak with them, that's fine, but just trying to make sure there's a communication ahead of time so that you know what to do and how to respond. You know, one of the other things is if you have a call center and you're a grocery store and somebody calls in to complain their rotisserie chicken wasn't hot, well, that phone number that's publicly out there is going to be the one that when grandma's missing, they're going to call that number. And so also having that strategy, right? Because whoever's answering those phones doesn't know what's going on necessarily, but just training them to understand if they get something like that, how to respond so that they don't say something that could upset someone that is in a panic moment as well.
Julie, for an organization out there that says, okay, we want to get out ahead of this. We want to have a plan. We want to have a point person, but I mean, we have some resources. We could pay for some training. I mean, how can people get trained with this kind of work or, you know, to be prepared for their organization?
So one of the things 4 years ago, I founded a group called the Private Sector Emergency Management Association. And it was with that idea that we needed a place for private sector to come together, whether you're a small business or a big company, along with our government partners and also our nonprofit partners. And through PSEMA, we actually offer those. We offer business continuity. We offer, if you're in a community that's being impacted and you're a member, we hold a daily call that says, hey, jump on. I can't tell you what the request is today. 1 year we had Hurricane Ian, we had somebody that was looking for fuel for their employees to go back to work. We were able to make that connection. The wildfires, I was able to help pull together support for the Los Angeles Children's Hospital. They needed pack-and-plays for families who lost their homes. And so PSEMA just brings together those people. But we're also rolling out a new training program this summer, into the fall now, that will offer those kind of resources you just talked about. And our membership rates are really, we're a trade association, so we have membership rates, but they're really reasonable for the resources you have access to. But not only the resources, but the broader network. So if something happens tomorrow and you need somebody to come in and help run your business for the next 3 days so that your employees can prepare for a hurricane, our end game, what we want to do is we will have a strike team that can come in and help those businesses. I don't have a vested interest in your business other than we want you to succeed and we want your employees to be able to prepare for that hurricane or that fire or whatever it may look like. Or maybe you've been directly impacted and we need to see if we can pull some resources in to help.
Julie, I love the vision there of PSEMA. I mean, it sounds like you're prepared to equip people and organizations with networking, with resources, with training, and especially for your smaller organizations, they might say, okay, we don't even know where to start. It sounds like they can go to PSEMA, and that's it's PSEMA.org. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah.
We have a lot of resources that are on the member side as well. Everything from your state resources of where to find information to how do you apply for SBA or FEMA assistance. So we have a lot of those resources. You know, if you're in a disaster and you're trying to go through and look for a resource online, you can go down a rabbit hole real quick. And so we just took it and tried to pull all those rabbits out of their holes and put them into one place to make it a little bit easier. Maybe it's an IRS document you're looking for, or maybe a best practice. We try to put all of it in one place.
Well, that's a good point. The road to recovery is a long, long road for people that have been through disasters. It sounds like you're streamlining that recovery process. Julie, we're here at one of our favorite segments already of the podcast called Weathered Wisdom. We're going to ask you to share with us a memory you have of an extreme weather event that you'll never forget, maybe something that impacted you professionally or personally. What's a weather event that impacted you so profoundly you're never going to forget it?
So I would actually have to say it would be Hurricane Dorian, which was 6 years ago this week. And I say that because we were, my boss at the time, Neil, and I went over to FEMA and we were at the NRCC for about 5 days. I finally calculated I worked somewhere around 150 hours in a 10-day period, which seems crazy. But for those that don't remember, Hurricane Dorian was this massive storm that was just coming and it was supposed to go across the state of Florida, which that meant we were going to have the entire state of Florida impacted into the Gulf. And then it went over and set over the Bahamas before it finally decided to move north, leaving a lot of devastation. But it tore apart the Bahamas and it was just that storm that would not go away. And so just continuing to watch it and to seeing what that devastation looked like in the Bahamas, and then It became infamously known as also Sharpie Gate because President Trump thought he would make sure that the storm was going to go to Alabama. And so professionally, I got caught up in all of the story of what was going on with the altered map. And again, I had worked about 150 hours. So I was, you know, working and get a phone call from somebody at the Hurricane Center who says, "Have you seen the news?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And they're like, "Somebody altered a NOAA map." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" So, you know, Hurricane Dorian was a big storm and was really an impact watching it happen. And then all of that kind of just snowballed into something else.
It became a bigger story than the storm itself. A lot of people forget, too, the margin of error. I mean, this was a Cat 5 sitting over the Bahamas, very thin margin of error just off the coast of Fort Lauderdale and Palm Beach. I mean, this was a major disaster in the making if it just shifted a little bit farther west into Florida, right?
Oh, if it had come across Florida, we'd be having a completely different story about Dorian. We're very lucky that it went ahead and moved up the coast. But it definitely became a bigger story after the fact. I mean, there was we were asked to put a statement out. I didn't write the statement, but everyone assumed I did because I was in a political job. And, you know, nothing like waking up on a Saturday morning after no sleep for 10 days to being on the front page of every major newspaper in America and knowing I couldn't really say or do much about it.
You know, it seems like in communications, sometimes something throws you a curveball. I mean, you're focusing at a storm and all of a sudden Sharpie Gate is the number one story in the world. I mean, how do you pivot to cover this stuff in a credible, reliable, professional way when things are like, you know, you get this curveball out of nowhere?
You know, we were carefully putting out the information and trying to provide the White House with the correct information to put out. That was a challenge on its own, a communication challenge. But at the same time, all of that was going on and these stories were happening about this map, we were still dealing with Hurricane Dorian. It was still sitting over the Bahamas when that story broke. And so as an emergency manager, my goal was to help communicate what was going on and where did we think Dorian was going to go next and the impacts. And how did we warn North Carolina and South Carolina and the other potential impacts of where it was going? So you almost have to compartmentalize at that point, right? I had to kind of put the Sharpie Gate story over here and know that somebody should be dealing with it that wasn't necessarily me, but while still continuing to talk with the FEMA leadership to make sure they knew where all the disaster, impacts could happen. Also trying to help communicate, like, what can we do to help the Bahamas, right? Like, so the Bahamas aren't the U.S., but I mean, people forgot that it was being obliterated for like 72 hours. And so it was all that kind of, multiple struggles there. Kind of also a different one was during one of the hurricanes in Florida. I'll never forget. Like, it was the middle of the hurricane. I'm walking around the state DOC and I get a phone call and it's like somebody and they say, oh, it's Fox Radio. And they wanted to do an interview. And I'm like, okay, well, when? And they're like, now, live. And I'm like, okay. So, and somebody said, how did you do that? And I said, well, I understand the facts of what we're doing and how to communicate it. So why wouldn't I do it? If I didn't feel comfortable, I wouldn't have. But and so as an emergency manager, you compartmentalize your life as well. Like, I could have something personal going on here, but my job is still to communicate whatever those hazards are and that information is to the public, because that's the important part.
Julie, is one of your keys to success really just making things very simple and facts-based? Like, just do you think in bullet points? I mean, it sounds like a lot of times you're taking very complex, broad stories and saying, how do we focus this into a couple bullet points that are simple, clearly communicated, and facts-based? What are your thoughts on that? Is that really one of the keys to your success there?
Yeah, there's an analogy called KISS, keep it simple, stupid. And it's really true, right? And so it is, especially when it comes to disasters, you can't have really long rambling bullets or talking points. You've got to keep it simple. What are the actions that have to be taken, whether it's a social media post or on an interview? What are the key actions that are the life safety things? What are the preparedness things you have to know? And how do you communicate that in the most simple way so that anyone can understand, whether it's somebody that maybe is visiting from another country and doesn't speak English as a first language, or maybe it's a child and you don't want to scare them, but they need to understand. We had a kids campaign in Florida that was all about preparing children, because then they become adults and they're prepared. But you have to keep it really simple. And it's really that way for every audience, right? Keeping it simple, helping them understand what the key points are at that moment. And then also admitting if you don't know something, you'll come back to them and answer the question.
Yeah, for sure. I've heard a lot of folks in the industry say maybe trying to communicate at a junior high or high school level and just trying to, get away from acronyms and just, again, like you said, keeping it really simple with a few main take-home messages.
Yeah, it needs to be plain English. I always laugh. FEMA is supposed to be plain English, but there's like a 100-page book of acronyms. So, you can't use a bunch of acronyms. You've got to keep it simple. You've got to be able to communicate whatever those key, especially if you have a storm or a fire or something that's moving out of community. It's like the weather service, right? Their alerts that go out are very short and simple alerts so that people can pay attention to it. You can't have this like five sentences and tell somebody what to do in an alert.
Julie, where do we go from here? I mean, what are the steps to clear communication as we move into, say, the next decade or so?
Well, one, understanding the hazards of where you are. And when I say hazards, it could be everything from a weather hazard to a man-made, whether it's, an active threat potential, or it's maybe you live in an area where there's an earthquake and we haven't had an earthquake in, 50 years type thing. And so it's understanding your hazards, understanding how to communicate with, if you're a business owner, one, with your employees, two, with any of your vendors. I always use the analogy that I can have a water vendor if I'm an emergency manager, but if my water vendor doesn't have a plan and they can't reopen, I don't have a water vendor any longer, right? And so it's also understanding, if you're on the private sector side, who are your vendors? How do you communicate with them? And also, how do you communicate with your employees? And I am all for, we live in a world of technology, but technology can fail tomorrow. And so I am still a believer in having certain things in a printed form in a folder in the event that you lose your technology and it's, now we're in the hurricane and you have no power and no technology. You better be able to pick up a piece of paper that has a phone number for me to call Hal and say, hey, we've got a problem.
Julie, I love that point. The key text messages, the phone numbers, the contact information, addresses, maps. How often are we're used to these smartphone maps? What happens if the cell network's down, right? Having a paper map, we've gotten away from this stuff, but in a disaster, all of a sudden that paper map may be life-saving, right?
Yeah, I showed up in Canada, forgot to turn on the cell service or the service on my phone. I had no map and I had to get to a hotel without a map. Luckily, I had printed the directions from the hotel because otherwise I would have had no idea where I was. So, I think we forget we are also connected to a device, that we forget that those devices aren't always going to be active. And if you have a cyber attack, you could have your system taken down. If you don't have a way to call someone or understand, my brother went to the Army and I handed him a phone book with everybody's phone numbers. And he was like, why, you know, boot camp, right? Why do I need that? And I said, because you're not going to have your cell phone. Do you have people's phone numbers memorized? He's like, no. And I'm like, okay, well here, mom and dad's phone numbers for you.
Yeah, sometimes the paper and pen, it'll go a lot farther than you think. Julie, our listeners, I know, are going to love this podcast. We focus a lot on clear communications. You're an expert in the field with all of these experiences. How can our listeners find you if they want to look you up, if they're like, hey, I want to bring this Julie person in to help consult us or help guide us? How can people find you?
So I'm on LinkedIn. It's my first, middle, and last name. So Julie, and then K-A-Y Roberts. So Julie K. Roberts. And then also my email, I'll give it to you. It's Julie, J-U-L-I-E, at jkroberts.com. And then also pesema.org. So P-S-E-M-A.org, which is where you can find information. And I'm always checking that. There's a contact button on there as well. So please reach out. I would love to talk with, whether it's a small business or a big business, whether you need to have a plan on how to communicate in a disaster or just a general communication plan for everyday work that happens that maybe you haven't thought about as well.
Thank you so much, Julie. We're in the heart of hurricane season so far. June, July, August, been pretty quiet, but we know in September things can change in a hurry. And I know a lot of our listeners are going to want to reach out to you, see what you're doing, the great work that you and your team are doing at Pesema. Julie, as we wrap up the podcast, what's one last take-home message you'd like to share with our listeners?
Whatever you do, stop today and make sure you have your personal plan, your family plan. Also, if you own a business, your business plan, have those ways to communicate. And then just also reach out and see if somebody else out there that you work with or you know have their plans, right? We've got to build a community of preparedness. We've gotten away from that. And with all the changes happening with how FEMA is going to respond to disasters, it's going to be on communities to respond. And so think about what your community looks like, whether that's your block, maybe it's your overall, if you live in a small community, or maybe it's your business community. But think about that and start to build that culture of preparedness today so we can all be better resilient when something does happen.
Julie, I'm really glad you mentioned resiliency starting at home. A lot of times, even professionals in the space, they have their professional plan, but don't have that home family plan. If your family isn't prepared, that's going to affect every aspect of your life, right?
Yeah, it starts at home. It does. And making sure your other family members have it as well.
Thank you so much, Julie. We're looking forward to following you. And something I loved about this podcast, we talked about hurricane season, but you and your team, you're covering all kinds of disasters, whether they're natural disasters, social disasters like active shooting, all this stuff, very relevant for everyone everywhere. And I know our listeners are going to really enjoy listening to this episode and reaching out to you as well.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Julie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I have a bunch of action items. It's short and sweet. I feel like this podcast, the concept is very simple, but it's very crucial for your organization to follow what Julie was talking about here, having a plan. Does your organization have a plan? Do you have that point person when things unravel that they can answer difficult questions? She mentioned that there's training available that you can prepare this person to deal with a crisis if it develops. She talked about KISS, keep it simple, stupid. Keep everything simple, very simple communication. She talked about you can actually develop a web page that's offline. If a crisis comes, you can put that online very quickly. A lot of what I heard from Julie is getting out ahead of things. So if a disaster strikes, you can respond very quickly. And I love what she talked about, just sharing simple facts. We don't have to speculate. And it's okay to say, we don't have certain pieces of information yet, but check back frequently for updates. That's fine to do. You want to keep it simple and you want to keep it factual. And you also want to contact Julie and her colleagues over at Pacima.org. That's P as in Papa, S as in Sierra, E as in Echo, M as in Mike, A as in Alpha. That's Pacima.org. They're doing a lot of training and providing resources for the private sector to deal and respond to disasters. Julie, thank you again so much for coming on the podcast. Thank you so much for our listeners for making us a top podcast on natural disasters. And of course, our team over at Blue Leopard Agency, senior video producer Jeremiah Long is the tech guru behind the scenes, making this sound awesome. And of course, the president of Blue Leopard Agency, Seneth Baker, always providing guidance and support as well. Thanks again for listening and tuning in. Again, so far when we're recording this, hurricane season, fairly low impact. But if something does hit, these topics and these insights from Julie Roberts are really going to help you and your organization respond. Until the next time, I'm the host of the GeoTrek podcast, Hurricane Hal. Catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.